It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the RTC weekly podcast. My name is Vlad. I will be your guest host this week while Mr. Dolan tends to an experiment in his laboratory. And since this week is Halloween, I have for you some wonderfully creepy old-time radio. The first is from Suspense and stars the king of creepy himself, Mr. Vincent Price. From 1956, this is Three Skeleton Key.
Suspense. And the producer of radio's outstanding theater of thrills, the master of mystery and adventure, William N. Robeson.
You are about to experience one of the most terrifying half hours in your entire life. Three Skeleton Key, starring Vincent Price. Oh yes, I realize superlatives tend to lose their significance by overuse. How many times have you been promised that a story would be the funniest, or the most dramatic, or the most exciting, only to find that it failed to live up to its advertising? The story you are about to hear is an exception. It is unconditionally guaranteed to chill your blood, unless you happen to love rats. We begin now with Mr. Vincent Price in Three Skeleton Key, a play well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Picture this place. A gray tapering cylinder welded by iron rods and concrete to the key itself. A bare black rock 150 feet long, maybe 40 wide. That's at low tide. At high tide, just the light rising 110 feet straight up out of the ocean. And all about it, the churning water, gray-green, scum-dappled, warm as soup. And swarming with gigantic bat-like devilfish, great violet schools of Portuguese man-o-war, and, yes, sharks, the big ones, the 15-footers. And as if this wasn't enough, there was a hot, dank, rotten-smelling wind that came at us day and night off the jungle swamps of the mainland. A wind that smelled like death. Set in the base of the light was a watertight bronze door. And in you went and up, yes, up and round, past the tanks of oil and the coils of rope, cases of wicks, racks of lanterns, sacks of spuds and cartons and cans, and up, round and round. Over the light storeroom was the food storeroom, and over the food storeroom was the bunk room where the three of us slept. And over the bunk room was the living and cooking room. And over the living and cooking room was the light. She was a beauty, balanced like a ballerina on the glistening steel axle of her rotary mechanism. At night, you'd lie there on the stone deck of the gallery with her revolving smoothly and quietly over your head, easing her bright white eye 360 degrees around the horizon. You'd lie there watching to see that the feeders kept working, that everything ran right. And it wouldn't be bad. The other two fellows snoring in their sacks two levels down. You'd smoke your pipe to kill the stink of the wind. It wouldn't be bad. About those other two, Louis and Auguste. What a pair. Louis, he was head man, was a big fellow from the Basque country, black beard, little hard black eyes, and a pair of arms that I tell you, those arms were as big around as my legs. Yeah, head man he was, and what word he let go was law. A silent fellow, and although I spent my first 2 weeks trying to strike up a real conversation, the most I could ever get out of it was...
I took up this profession because I don't like people. They talk too much. It's quiet work, light tending. Let's keep it that way. Understand? You're getting to be as bad as a beast. I thought maybe...
That was Louis. And when he accused me of becoming like Auguste, I quieted down, because Auguste was the talkingest man I've ever met. The talkingest and the ugliest. He was hunchbacked, stood 4 feet high, had red hair and big blue eyes. It seems he'd been an actor in Paris.
Played over 200 different productions, dear boy. That's a grand guignol. Oh, but it was monstrous. Horrible. The way we used to scare the audience. I was hated. Yes. They used to throw things and hiss and bare their teeth at me. Well, finally it got too bad. I couldn't stand it any longer. No, I gave up the theater. My nerves, you understand. Yes, I gave it up completely. I really did. I couldn't stand it any longer.
It all started one morning at 2:30. I was on watch, lying on the cool stone deck, pulling on my pipe, staring out at the blackness, the phosphorescent combers, and the big yellow stars, when out of the corner of my eye, I noticed something show up for a second. Something the light had touched, far off. I waited for her to come around again, and when she did, there it was. A three-master, a big one, about a half mile off, and coming down out of the nor-nor-west, coming straight for us. Now, you must understand, our light was where it was for a very good reason. Dangerous submerged reefs surrounded us, and ships kept clear, but this one, this sailing vessel, was coming straight on. I went over to the gallery door and yelled, "Light! Light!
What?
Ship headed for the reef!
Coming right up!"
I had the glasses out now. Couldn't read her name, but I could see her quite plainly. All sails set, the foam creaming away under her bow, her beautiful lines. A Dutch ship, I guessed it. But why didn't she turn? Every time it passed, our light hit her with the glare of day.
Ship? Where?
Nor-nor-west. The light will touch her in a moment.
Can't they see?
Look at her. She just keeps coming on.
The square heads.
What is it? What is it?
Watch nor nor west.
I know. I know what it is.
What?
The Dutchman. The Flying Dutchman.
She's derelict. That's it.
Derelict?
Abandoned. The crew left her for some reason or other, but instead of sinking, she's gone on. Running before every wind.
She'll not run long. Not with these reefs to break her up.
A beautiful ship. Now, why would men leave a beautiful ship like that?
We watched her the rest of those black hours, heeling and rocking, pushed and pulled by every stray wind, every freak current. Watched her until the dawn came, till the sea turned from black to a pearly gray. And on she came again, heading for us. We all had our glasses trained on her now.
Auguste, you can kill the light.
Right, Chief.
She doesn't look so good by daylight. Do you think she'll ground this time? I say, do you think she'll ground this time?
This is impossible. Absolutely impossible.
Why?
Here, take my glasses. They're stronger than yours.
All right. What is it? I had to focus, and then my breath froze in my throat. The decks were swarming with a dark brown carpet that looked like a gigantic fungus, but undulating. And on the masts and yards, the guys and all were hundreds, no, thousands, no, I don't know, an inestimable number of tremendous rats.
See them?
Yes, yes, I see them.
Now we know why she's a derelict.
Yes, now we know.
What are you two doing here? Give me a look.
Yeah, yes, give him the glasses. Take a good look, Chatterbox.
Huh?
Give you something to talk about.
She's still heading for us.
Yeah.
Look, if she's going to turn, she'd better turn soon.
Suppose she doesn't.
You mean suppose she piles up on the quay?
It's low tide.
Yeah. Yes, yes, it is.
Well, where's all the conversation? Boogies?
No!
Huh?
No!
She's still coming on.
Go away!
Turn.
Go away!
Turn, will you turn? I say, I pray you turn. Cracked up.
Rats! Look! On the water, like a carpet.
Swimming.
Sure, they're swimming. Those are ship rats.
They're swimming for the rocks.
The door below, it's open.
Yes, come on.
Down he went, racing down the stone stairs, taking them three and four at a time. Scared. You can bet we were scared.
Bogus, you get the windows. Maybe they can climb. We don't know.
Right, Chief, but hurry. Hurry.
See them?
No. Oh, oh, yes, I do, yes. Up at the other end of the rock.
Look at them. Me! They smell us. Here they come. Close the door.
I can't. It's stuck.
Oh, here, let me.
You move.
You made it.
Holy. That was close.
One got in. Look, there.
We'll get him.
Watch it. He's kicking.
Oh, what a brute.
It's as big as a tomcat. Bigger. His eyes were wild and red, his teeth long and sharp and yellow. He went for a starving ravenous. And we fought him, fought that one rat all over the room. It was all, believe me, I do not exaggerate. It was like fighting a panther.
Got him.
We'd better get aloft.
Yeah.
We ran up the winding staircase. We passed the tiny windows of the various levels. And at every one was a thick, wriggling, screaming curtain of brown fur. I was ahead of Louie, and I dreaded each successive level. Suppose they had found a way in.
Look at them. Oh, will you look at them?
It's a nightmare.
Will you look at them?
The air of the gallery was thick and fetid with the stink of them. The light was dim brown, filtered through the crawling mass that swarmed over the glass all about us. We could not see the sky, nothing, nothing but them. Their red eyes, their claws, their wriggling hairy snouts, and their teeth. The rats, they screamed and howled and threw themselves against the glass. They were starving, and we three, we stood quietly, very, very quietly, in the center of the glass room, under our beautiful light. And we waited.
What can we do? What can we do, Chief?
Take it easy, Yogi.
Take it easy.
It won't do any good. It won't do any good to stand here and shake.
That's right.
Go away. Go away. Do you hear me? Go away this instant.
They won't go away. Not until...
Finish it, Chief. Not until what?
Not until they've been fed.
You can take just so much horror, and then you get used to it. And they were interesting to watch, you know. They couldn't understand the glass. They could see us and they could rush at us, but that thin, invisible barrier held them off, stopped them. From time to time, we caught a glimpse of the rocks below. More rats down there, swarming brown velvet in the bright tropical sunlight. And then the tide began to rise.
If only it had drowned some of them.
Ship rats don't drown. You can't drown one of them.
Look, they're all climbing up the tower.
Yeah, this bunch around us is getting thicker.
Say, what's the time, huh?
6:15.
You've got first watch.
Yes, that's right.
At 10.
I will.
Come along, Auguste.
It was getting dark. One side of the room was lit a soft, filtered red. Sunset through the rats. Oh, very pretty. I set the wicks, checked my fuel, and then lit the lamp. It caught them. Lit them in their gigantic wriggling web of pale, hairless bellies, twitching red tails, bright eyes. And then I started the rotary motor. The light drove them mad. As she swung slowly and smoothly about, she blinded them in the fierce stabbing bar of light, moving continually about, ever turning, ever touching, ever moving around and around, and they twitching and shuddering, eyes flaming when they were struck by the light. The bright light moving and behind on the dark side of the room, so close, I dared not turn my back, which cannot help turning your back when you are in a room made of glass. On the dark side of the room, you could not see them, but only their eyes, thousands of points of blank red light, blinking and twinkling like the stars of hell. Louis relieved me at 10. But as you may imagine, I didn't get much sleep that night. And when I came up into the gallery early the next morning, there stood Auguste. He was bowing to the rats, waving his arms, and so help me, making
audience,
a speech.
My dear audience, I am going to play once again that magnificent role which made me the toast of the Paris theater. Prelati, the evil genius of the medieval underworld. I am he who did guide the dark soul of the Marechal into the nether paths. Do not be frightened, little children. I will not hurt you much.
He kept turning. I stood staring at him, horror struck, but he didn't notice me. The man had gone mad. He kept turning, telling his stories to all the rats, leaving not one out. August!
Another one. A latecomer. Take a seat on the aisle, dear Patrick.
Oh, stop it! Stop it! He didn't stop. He went on bowing and scraping to the rats, his big blue eyes rolling and winking, his wild red hair waving about him. I grabbed him by the arm and slapped his face. He looked at me like a child, and then his face screwed up. He looked as though he were about to cry. Go below, August. Go on.
Oh, very well, then. Later, my dear audience. Later. Matinee today.
Sure, he was crazy. But I guess we all were. A few hours later, he came back up and caught Louis and me teasing the rats. Yes, sounds horrible. It was fun. We would get right up against the glass and make faces at them. It drove them crazy. They would scratch away, trying to get at our eyes. Louis was even cuter about it. He'd pull a piece of bread out of his pocket and press it against the glass. The rats would scramble into a solid ball, biting each other, clustering like grapes. From time to time, a whole knot of them would slip and fall 110 feet to the surf below.
Look at the sharks.
They're eating them.
No, those sharks are our friends. I'll get another bunch together. Here, my beauty. That's it. Pile up. Kill each other. There they go.
August joined in too. Very ingenious, August. He learned that if he spread-eagled himself against the glass, they'd bunch and bundle against his figure. Then he'd leap back.
Look! My portrait in rats!
It went on all day, and then I was lying in bed. It was about midnight. I was very tired, and I was just beginning to fall off to sleep when I became conscious of a new sound. I couldn't figure it at first. I got up, lit the lamp, and went to the window. Even as I looked at it, I saw one of the panes begin to sag in. They had eaten the wood away. Louis, come quick.
What is it?
They found a way in. I held the glass with my hand. Now they were all going crazy, and assured of the success of this maneuver, they were all nibbling away at the wood. Louis ran below and then returned with a large sheet of tin. We spread it against the window and hammered it into place. Even as we did so, I felt the heavy body thudding against the other side as the window gave way.
That ought to hold. If it doesn't, we're done for.
Rats can't eat tin.
No, they can't. What was that?
I don't know.
It came from below.
The storeroom window.
They're in. They're swarming up the stairs.
Drop the trap.
Light.
Two of them got in.
Go after them.
We didn't have to go after them. They came at us. I leapt to one side and grabbed a marlin spike, swung and smashed one in midair. I whirled to see Louis with the other. It had ripped his hand open and the blood was pouring all over the place. He held his hand aloft and kicked at the snarling rat. I stepped and swung and got it.
My hand. He's got my hand.
That's the both of them, Louis. I'll get you something to tie that up.
Blood, look at it, my blood. I'm bleeding.
Don't worry about it, Louis. Don't worry. Now, here, look. I'll wind this kerchief around it. It'll be okay.
Blood.
There. Blood. No, it's not bad. Just the flesh.
My blood.
Then I became conscious of a new sound. They were gnawing their way through the wooden trap door. I watched the planks, fascinated, and even as I did, it began to give way. A bristling, whiskery snout showed through. Louis, we've got to go up. Level was the living quarters and kitchen. I slammed the flap there, too, but it, too, was wood.
Oh, my blood. What are we going to do?
I don't know. They'll be through this one in a moment.
The gallery. The trap door in the gallery is metal.
Good. Come on. We made it. We lay across the trap, exhausted, while below us the rats took over the entire tower. I could hear them howling and fighting over our food supply, our water, our leather, and all about us the others screamed and glared in at us, swayed in a tangled mess, hypnotized by the ever-turning light. By morning, the air in the little room was horrible. To now, we'd been getting air from the tower below. Now that was sealed off, and so was all our food and water. We lay exhausted, panting, waiting. And the hours crawled on. I was almost dozing from fatigue when I saw a sight that brought me too fast.
Would you like to come in, my beauty? Will you? I hold the powers of life and death, and I can let you in, you know.
August was standing by the glass, and in one hand he held a big wrench. He was tapping the glass, gently, not quite hard enough to break it. I eased myself to my feet and slowly, very slowly, I tiptoed toward him.
All I have to do is just a little harder and...
I found a coil of wire in the tool kit and I trussed him up, fastened him to a stanchion in the center of the room. Louis was of no help. He lay on his side looking at his bloody hand, weak and sick as a baby. So there I was, a lunatic and a coward for company, and all about watching our little drama, the rats. The day dragged by. The supply boat wasn't due for another 12 days. I don't know what they could have done if they had come. And we had only one way of summoning them. That was to shoot off distress rockets, but the rockets were four floors below. And even if they'd been right there in the gallery, I couldn't have opened a window to fire them. That night I tended the light, but its flame was devouring our oxygen. The following day we lay, thirst tormented, starving, waiting. The following night I again tended the light, but the small supply of spare wicking we kept in the gallery had become exhausted, and quite suddenly, at about midnight, the light went out. There was nothing I could do. Wicks were stored three levels below. Nothing I could do, nothing. From time to time, I'd strike a match to see the clock. And when I did, it lit up the million red eyes about us. All about us, watching, waiting. Below, it had grown quiet. They'd cleaned us out, and now they, too, were waiting. All waiting. And then, the rats, quite suddenly, were silent. And then I heard it. And then I saw the sky and the stars. The rats were gone. I went to the glass. Out there on the water, a small freighter, a banana boat showing a few lights, came softly and innocently at us. The light was out. They didn't know. I wanted to open the windows to call out to them, to warn them somehow, but I was afraid. What if the rats were hiding from me, tricking me? So I waited. She grounded very softly on a reef not 200 yards from the quay. Grounded so gently that the man playing the cornet, was he a passenger, a crewman off watch, didn't even stop playing. They tried washing her back off. I could have told them to save their fuel. The tide was rising, would have floated her free. And I waited. Well, that's all. That's the story. The sun came up and there wasn't a rat on the whole quay. Every last one of that terrible army had deserted us. Gone back to sea on their new ship. August? Insane asylum, he never recovered. Louis, they took him into Cayenne where he died of blood poisoning from his bite. Life on Three Skeleton Key isn't bad these days. But sometimes, when I see a strange vessel approaching, I get a little nervous. Sure. Somewhere on the seas, there's a little banana boat without a crew. That is, without a human crew.
Suspense. in which Vincent Price starred in Three Skeleton Key with John Daner and Ben Wright. Suspense. Suspense is written and directed in Hollywood by William N. Robeson. Three Skeleton Key was adapted by James Poe from the story by George G. Toudouze. Leith Stevens composed and conducted the original score. Sound pattern by Cliff Thorsness, Gus Bays, and Ray Kemper. George Walsh speaking.
Suspense is presented by the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
One typically thinks of Halloween. One commonly also thinks of macabre stories such as those written by Edgar Allan Poe. My next selection for you is one such story from the CBS Mystery Theater, The Fall of the House of Usher. Enjoy, my friends.
To the sounds of suspense, to the fear you can hear. Horror that makes the flesh crawl as with maggots, terror that turns the brain to jelly. These mark the work of Edgar Allan Poe. For nearly a century and a half, readers have wondered at the mad creations of his fevered brain, even as their blood ran cold with fear. As shall yours. Our mystery drama, The Fall of the House of Usher, was especially adapted from the Edgar Allan Poe classic for the Mystery Theater by George Lowther and stars Kevin McCarthy. I'll be back shortly with Act One. Warn you that there lies ahead for you a tale so gruesome that when it ends, you will know beyond doubt that never in your life before have you experienced such revulsion. Are you prepared for this? Come then to a certain room where a man named Gabriel Mannering sits writing in his diary. A certain room in the House of Usher.
I sit here writing this diary, when in truth, were I not a fool, I should have already departed this frightful place. Already I have sensed such horrors in these first hours of my visit that I tremble at the thought of what may be in store for my friend Roderick Usher, and for me. During the whole of this dull, dark autumn day, I had passed on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of evening drew on, within a view of this bleak and melancholy house, the House of Usher. I felt at once an iciness, a sickening of my heart, and wondered what it was that so unnerved me. I was soon to find out.
You would be Mr. Mannering, sir?
Yes.
My master awaits you.
One moment, my horse.
Oh, we'll be well cared for, sir.
Mm. Oh, that carriage standing there. That black carriage? Is there another visitor?
Only the doctor. He is attending Miss Madeline. This way, sir.
Thank you.
Follow me now, sir.
Mm.
We turn here, the passage on our left.
Hmm?
Now, this to the right.
I had no idea. The House of Usher was so vast.
Ah, yes. Vast. Above and below.
Below?
There are chambers underground, vaults, dungeons, that even I have never seen. And I have lived here as servant to Mr. Usher more than 30 years. Here we are, sir.
Come.
Mr. Gabriel Mannering, sir.
Oh, Gabriel. My dear good friend, you've come. You've come at last.
Roderick, I came immediately on receipt of your letter. It gave me cause for concern. Deep concern, after all, Roderick. Not having seen each other in years, nor corresponded even, to receive a letter from you was in itself a surprise, but the contents, Roderick, the contents were a shock. How ill are you?
Ill? I'm not ill.
Not ill? But in your letter...
I am not ill! Oh, I may have mentioned something of the sort in my letter, but...
More than mentioned, you spoke of acute bodily illness, of oppressive mental disorder, of a malady, dear friend, so strange you could not bear to face it alone. Now, that is why I'm here. That is why I came at once. The terrible agitation in your letter.
Oh, mood. It was nothing but mood. Mood of the moment. Nothing more.
Come now.
Cato, the port. Good. Thank you. I'll pour. And, Cato.
Sir?
Dr. Wyndham is with my sister still?
Yes, sir.
I would speak with him before he takes his leave, if he feels I can bear to...
Sir?
Nothing. Just say I wish to see him.
Yes, sir.
The vintage Port Gabriel, you'll enjoy it. Its aroma, its fragrant bouquet will delight your nostrils. Its taste will fall sweet on your tongue. Your health, good friend.
And yours, Roderick.
Well, now, tell me about yourself, Gabriel. How has life gone with you all these years?
Oh, as all lives go, I suppose. Has been the good, the bad, the indifferent.
Yes, mine has been mostly bad.
I've prospered. My importing business in Baton Rouge.
Ruination, that's been my lot, my fate. The fate of the House of Usher.
Well, if you are financially in need...
No. I speak of another kind of ruination. Decadence. I speak of the evil. The evil that molders within my body, my mind, my house. House? Oh, no. No house, this. A tomb. A tomb that houses the living dead.
You are ill.
Yes. Yes, I lied. I am ill with...
What? With what?
With fear.
Fear? Of what?
I know not. Well, what do we all fear, each of us? What living thing has not known fear? It lives within us, this fear. It rots within us, as I rot within this house. But mark you, good friend, whereas with others fear rides like a restless maggot only now and again, with me it's ever present, a colorless slime growing within me, spreading, engulfing, drowning me.
Roderick.
No. I'm all right now. I'm all right. You must go.
Go?
Well, you shouldn't have come. I shouldn't have asked you. You must leave this house of death, this tomb.
Stop that. Now stop.
I tell you that...
Enough. Enough now. Here. Sit down. Compose yourself. Now hear me, Roderick. I came a great distance through the foulest time of the year to be with you, and here I shall stay until you are well again.
But you don't understand. I shall never get well.
Of course you will.
No. She is dying, you see, and I...
Your sister? Is it she who is dying?
Yes, Madeline.
But it's she who is dying. If it is...
No, you don't understand. You don't understand.
Come in.
Dr. Wyndham.
Fine. Come in, Doctor. Thank you, Cato. May I introduce myself, Doctor? Mr. Usher, as you see, is not himself. I'm a friend of his. Gabriel Manning of Baton Rouge.
Oh, how'd you do? Louis Wyndham.
I entreat your pardon, both of you.
Now, Roderick.
My nerves sometimes.
Yes, I know, and I'm sure Mr. Mannering understands. You've been taking the laudanum I prescribed?
I used the last only yesterday.
Well, I'll see if you get more.
Oh, thank you. My sister?
There's no change.
How long? Before death.
I don't know. Your sister's malady baffles me. I don't know what is killing her, nor do I know what keeps her alive, when in truth, she's all but dead.
Oh, would it be an impertinence, Doctor, for me to ask you what you mean by that?
Well, no, Mr. Mannering. Quite simply, there have been times when Miss Usher, Madeline, has been devoid of all vital signs. And by this, I mean I've been unable at these times to detect a pulse, blood pressure, any respiration whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yet, moments later, she's opened her eyes and returned to the world of the living.
Strange.
Yeah, I've encountered nothing like it in years of practice. It's not too far from the truth to say that she is dead, and yet she lives on.
Yes. Like the house itself.
Now, Roderick, you mustn't harp on...
I tell you, we are like this house, my sister and I. We are this house. The house is us. The house is dead, and yet it stands.
Your aberration about this house...
It is no aberration. It's the truth. The house of Usher crumbles, yet it will not fall. Madeline is dead, yet she will not die. And as for me, oh, heaven, the horror that awaits me.
I'll send the laudanum as soon as possible, Mr. Mannering. There's little else I can do.
Yes.
I have other patients to attend.
Oh, no.
Thank heaven it's a moonlit night. I have many miles to travel. Good night.
Good night. Roderick. Roderick.
Yes.
Roderick, I want to help you in every way I can. That's why I'm here. But now, you must do your part to help yourself.
What do you mean?
Well, I could be wrong, but it seems to me you let yourself go to pieces all too easily. This talk, this wild talk of your sister Madeline being dead and yet alive. Well, now, that's nonsense, you know.
No.
Yes, well, I'll agree with you with one thing. One thing only. In a way, you have become this damnable house. No healthy, sane man could live here for long without beginning to lose his sanity, without serious damage to his nervous system. I've never seen such gloom, inside as well as out. This very room reeks of dejection, despondency, undusted cobweb furnishings, black drapes covering the window. Here, let me throw them back and at least get some moonlight, if not sunlight, into this place. There. That's... Roderick.
What is it?
There's a graveyard. I can see it in the moonlight.
The family graveyard, yes.
Who would be walking in it at night?
What do you say? Well, where do you see this?
There. Amidst the headstones.
Oh. It's Madeline. What is she doing out there? Well,
we'd better go and find out.
Good Lord.
In the doorway. What is it?
Madeline! Am I that horrifying to look upon? Dear brother.
Madeline Usher walks among the headstones of the Usher graveyard, yet stands in the doorway at the same time. Does her spirit walk abroad? Is she that close to death? I'll be back shortly with Act Two. Again, I must ask if you wish to go on, and warn that if you do, you will experience a kind of horror for which I can find no words. Even Gabriel Mannering, writing in his diary, found it difficult to express his feelings in that moment of first meeting with Madeline Usher.
I seek and cannot find words to recreate the terror of that moment. Not a woman, but a corpse stood before us in the doorway of that awful room. The very woman, or corpse, if you will, that but an instant before Roderick Usher and I had glimpsed in the moonlight graveyard beyond the window. If she is alive, I thought, she should be dead. Fatuously, I said, "You are Madeline Usher?"
"Yes."
"How do you do? I'm Gabriel Mannering."
"I know. Ah, you winced as you took my hand."
"What?"
"You felt it. Coldness."
No.
Yes. You need not dissemble with me. Even now, you find it hard not to stare at the dark patches on my face, the putrescence that lives. Yes. Thrives in my dying flesh.
Madeline, my dearest sister, you should be lying down, resting. You mustn't waste your energy.
I wanted to meet your friend. Someone from the world of life outside this house. This tomb. I wanted to... need it.
Falling, catch her. Put her on the couch, Gabriel. No. Better still, we'll carry her to her room. No pulse. No heartbeat. Is she...
Well, heaven help me. It's impossible to say. Can you carry her alone?
She weighs nothing.
Follow me, then. Oh, what evil stalks the house of Usher. Help us, dear Lord. Please help us.
Put her down, Gabriel. Gabriel.
In what?
In that?
It's her bed.
A coffin.
Well, nevertheless, it is her bed. It's where she rests and sleeps.
And haven't you noticed what she's wearing isn't a nightdress?
A shroud.
Yes. She's been ready for her burial for nearly a year now. Oh, look, see? Her eyes are fluttering.
I'd have taken my oath she was
not
dead.
Not yet.
Oh. Gabriel, my friend, come. Well, you don't leave her like this, alone, no company to cheer her when she wakes.
She may not waken again for days. She may not waken again.
Come. No. I don't wake. There's something about her. Something in her face. It reminds me. Well, of course, it's you.
Oh, you see, then?
The family resemblance. Obvious. In spite of what the intimacy of death has done to the face, the resemblance is still there.
It's more than a resemblance, Gabriel.
What do you mean?
Well, we are twins.
As my friend spoke those words in that chamber of death, a curious change came into his face. It floats before me even now as I write, a complexion gone so suddenly cadaverous, his eyes large, liquid and luminous beyond comparison, thin and pallid, lips gone thinner, paler. For a moment, he seemed scarce human. I had tried to calm his fevered nerves by telling him it was his sister, not he, who was dying. And he had cried out...
You don't understand. You don't understand.
And now, in an instant, I did understand, or at least the shadow of what he meant touched me, and I was filled with a dread, a loathing of what was to come that I cannot fully express. Had I known the full truth of what lay before us, my loathing would have increased 100-fold, and I should have fled the house of Usher then and there, certainly. I should not have found myself at breakfast with Usher the following morning.
Another helping, Mr. Mannering?
No more, Cato.
Then I can give you the message.
A message from whom?
Miss Madeline. She wishes to see you at your convenience.
Well, then I'll go to her, of course. Now, why do you look at me like that? And now, why do you turn away? Cato, face me. Look at me. What is it?
Cato, is it the odor?
Yes, sir.
You'd best not go, Gabriel, or if you do, another time.
I don't understand.
The odor, the stench of putrefaction. It's stronger at times than at others.
And you mean that she... Take me to Miss Madeline at once, Cato.
No, no. It will sicken you, nauseate you, even infect you.
Well, it can kill me and be damned to it, but I'll not disregard a last wish of a dying woman. Unlike you, Roderick, I do not fear death. Miss Usher. Madeline. Are you too tired to speak now?
No.
Would you prefer I came back another time?
Oh, how good of you to come at all.
It's a privilege to be of use to you.
Favor. I wish a favor.
Anything in my power.
I want to die. I'm in such pain and I want to die, but I cannot.
Cannot?
I'm afraid.
There's nothing to fear. Death is only sleep, dreamless sleep. No, don't fear death.
I fear.
You fear what?
Burial alive.
Why would you have such a fear? What makes you think you might be buried alive?
My mother.
She?
Promise me.
Spare yourself. Spare yourself. You need say no more. I promise. I promise you that you will not be buried alive. Rest. Rest now. Rest. That is what you meant, Roderick, is it not? Like her, like your twin, you don't fear death so much as you fear being buried alive.
Right, part of it. Yeah? Yes.
Only part?
Well, I fear... Oh, God, more than I can tell you. I fear what happens in death.
Another aberration. As with the house, so with this. You are a man given to aberration.
And what of that? You make as little sense as Wyndham. You think because you call a thing an aberration, it'll go away. That it will cure itself if you but name it.
Reason. Common sense.
Reason. Common sense. Well, you speak to me and Usher, of reason and common sense, hmm? Do you not know of the madness that has tainted this family through its history? From the beginnings of the house of Usher, this house, this family... Until now, until Madeline and me, the last of the Ushers, from beginning to end, from rise to fall.
Roderick.
Rise to fall.
Roderick.
From rise to fall. I had not thought on it before, but that is what it will be when she and I are dead. It will be the fall of the House of Usher.
Yes, Cato.
The laudanum, sir, from Dr. Wyndham.
Oh, thank heaven. It has come none too soon.
Mr. Mannering, sir.
What? Oh, yes. Yes, Cato.
You've been sitting here in the graveyard for nearly 2 hours.
That long?
Yes, sir.
Tell me, Cato, how long have you been servant to Mr. Usher?
More than 30 years, sir. But I thought I told you that the night you arrived just a week ago.
Did you? Now, then I forgot. Were you here when the mother died? The mother of Mr. Roderick and Miss Madeline.
Why do you ask such a question, Miss Madeline?
I don't know. I don't know, really, except I've been dwelling on what Miss Madeline told me about her mother. Buried alive. Was she indeed?
Sir, don't ask such questions. Don't dwell on such thoughts.
Why not? It was discovered the mother had been buried alive.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Sir, I entreat you. Understand, you cannot stay in the house of Usher. No one can without something, I know not what, but something evil taking possession of his mind, his spirit, his very soul. It will happen to you. It is happening to you.
No.
You've been drawn here to this spot. You've been sitting here in the damp and chill for hours because you, too, have taken the first step toward madness.
How did they discover she'd been buried alive?
Sir, I beg you, turn your thoughts away from...
How?
If you must hear it. A few weeks after she had been buried, the coffin placed in that vault you see under the trees, it was discovered that she had been buried wearing a valuable ring.
A ring?
It contained a stone worth a fortune. It had been...
Tell me about it.
She had always worn it, and when the undertaker encoffined her, he neglected to remove it. He had no idea of its worth, or surely he'd have inquired whether the family wished her to wear it to the grave. And as you will understand, such was Miss Madeline's and Mr. Roderick's grief. They didn't think of the ring until weeks later.
And decided to retrieve it.
Yes. We went to the vault, the three of us. Slid back the slab that covers it and... Sir, let us go in.
Finish. Finish what you're telling me.
There lay the coffin. The lid was in two parts. A lower part that covered her body from the waist down. An upper part from the waist up. This I... pried up, and there...
Go on.
She lay face down. Her hands had torn chunks of hair out by the roots. Such was the agony of terror. Hands, do I say? Claws. They had become rigid in the death throes.
Yes. Yes?
We turned her over. Her face, Oh, my God, we were... Her face, I cannot describe. I cannot.
Enough, then. Oh, chill is getting to me.
No!
Quickly, Tom.
Heaven help us, what is that?
Coming toward us from the house. Roderick!
Help me!
What?
Help me!
Roderick, what is it, ma'am?
A corpse!
What?
Madeline, dead. She's dead at last, dead, but...
What? What is it?
She tried to take me to the grave with her. She tried to drag me into her coffin.
No.
Roderick, pull yourself together and tell us.
I went to her chamber to see how she was. I called her name again and again and again, and no answer. I felt for a pulse, none. I lay my head against her breast, no heartbeat, and then...
Oh, God! Her arms were entwined around my neck, her cold arms around my neck, and I tried to break free, but I couldn't. I grabbed her wrists and I tore her arms from her.
Sir, I've got him. Help me carry him inside.
Oh, no.
I'll be calm, Cato. When Mr. Usher tore himself free, he must have dragged her half out of the coffin. Come. We must put her back in. Cato.
I
dare not touch her.
Very well. There.
Is she at last dead?
She seems so. Ride for the doctor. Tell him to come at once.
Yes, sir. Sir, you mean to stay here?
Yes.
But I will be gone at least 2 hours. You change your mind.
I grabbed her wrist.
Find your way back to the library in that maze of corridors.
Well, don't worry about it. I shall stay here. I made her she'd not be buried alive, and I mean to keep that promise, Cato. Beginning now.
Alone in that chamber of death, within the House of Usher, Gabriel Mannering seats himself beside the coffin of Madeline Usher to keep his vigil and his promise, and wonders if he himself may not be going mad. I'll be back shortly with Act Three. Awful as to shatter the human mind, haunts the House of Usher, hangs like a shroud in the air, drips on the spirit like the very slime upon the decaying walls. As Gabriel Mannering sits beside the coffin of Madeline Usher, he feels this terror seeping into him.
Seeping into me like a rising tide of pollution. Cato said he would be gone 2 hours in fetching Dr. Wyndham, but to me, it seemed like 20 before I heard his returning footsteps.
You don't look well.
I'm all right.
Sir, you deceive yourself. Well, never mind now. I'm seeing Miss Usher. I beg, Cato. Thank you. Heart first.
Mm-hmm. Is she?
No, there's no heartbeat. None whatever. No pulse. No vital signs at all.
She is gone, then.
Hey, Mr. Mannering, I have attended her in this strange illness for nearly a year. I've seen her in this state 4 times before.
What's to be done?
What indeed? Well, I would wait a few days at least, and then I should bury her.
No.
No.
She feared to be buried alive.
Yes, I know. Her mother.
You attended her?
No, another man. From what I've been able to learn, I judge her illness was similar, just as unaccountable as baffling. Well, Mr. Mannering, she did indeed fear the same fate her mother suffered, but I think that after, say, 3 or 4 days...
I say no. At least. At least a week. No. No, 2. Even 3.
You don't know what you're saying. You can't keep a body for 2 or 3 weeks. Especially hers.
Why especially hers?
Well, look at her, man. Here. See? Under the skin of the cheeks. Those gray patches. She's partially decomposed already.
I gave her my word, Doctor. I said we would make sure.
There is an evil in this house. A sinister, malevolent thing that fastened itself on the Ushers years ago. And is beginning to fasten itself on you.
Now, hear me out.
I have not seen you in some days. The moment I came into this room, I saw it. I tell you, I saw it. The change in you. The sickening in you. I do not use this word lightly, Mr. Mannering. The insanity in you.
You are right. I gave Madeline Usher my word she would not be buried alive, and she will not be.
Well, I see that I cannot dissuade you. Very well. Do as you wish. And may God help you.
I stayed by her coffin for yet another hour or so, making sure there were no signs of life. Then I returned to the library, led there, of course, by Cato, for I could never have found my own way through that maze of corridors and passages. I found Roderick Usher seated bolt upright in a wing chair, staring at I know not what. Roderick, I must talk to you. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Now, Roderick, as I told you, I promised your sister to take every precaution against her being buried alive.
She is dead. I know it in my heart, my soul. I know it.
I believe so, too. But we must be certain. Now, that presents a problem. Roderick, are you listening?
Problem?
Yes. Decomposition. If she is dead, she will decompose. And after a period of days, well, if you could imagine...
Days? Days of what?
Of visiting her coffin, at least every 12 hours, say, to make sure she's dead.
Are you mad?
We must keep her body. 1 week, two. And the question is, where?
Where?
We'll have to leave the coffin open, in case she should regain her senses. On the other hand, if she is indeed dead...
There are vaults deep down beneath the house. We could put the coffin in one of those.
Good. Good. We'll do that then. Yes. We'll do just that. Together, Usher and I arranged for the temporary entombment of Madeline, his twin. The vault, so long unopened that our torches were half smothered in its oppressive atmosphere, was small, damp, and entirely without means of admission of light, lying at great depth beneath the house.
There, Gabriel. It is done.
We must come here again. In no more than 12 hours.
As you say. As you say.
Before he wished only to bury Madeline, or he'd become so compliant, agree so readily with what I said. Only I'd ask myself that question. But I did not, and consequence faced an unexpected problem.
Why do you not believe me?
It isn't that I don't believe you, Roderick. I wish to see for myself.
There is no need for you to do it. I have done it.
You have?
I have visited the coffin at least once every 12 hours, sometimes twice. She does not live. My word for it.
It is my word concerns me. I gave my word to her, not yours.
She is dead. I assure you, she's dead.
It was about that time the sounds began. Strange knockings, creaking. Perhaps it had begun before, but I had not at first. I would hear some curious sound from below and say to Roderick, what was that?
What was what?
Listen. What is that?
Rats, perhaps? Rats? Well, the house is infested with them.
I've never heard rats make sound like that. I answered. Time went on. And it seemed to me the sounds grew louder, and I would say to Rock, listen. And he would answer.
A door banging in the wind somewhere.
And I would say, there is no wind. He would answer.
Well, then it's something else. Don't bother me.
And on that fatal night, as we sat in the library, he sitting, staring vacantly, nothing, trying to read, but my mind was on that awful chamber of death far below, outside the wind gathering for a storm. It happened. I came aware of distinct, hollow, metallic, yet muffled reverberation. Complete unnerved, I leaped to my feet and looked at Usher. His eyes were fixed before him, and throughout his whole countenance there reigned a stony rigidity. I said, Roderick, do you not hear it?
Yes, I hear it and have heard it, as you have. Long, long, many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard. Yet I dared not speak. No, touch me not. I am accursed. Accursed! For I heard the sounds as did you, but I dared not speak and dared not go.
Not go? My God, are you telling me
that not once have I gone out to sea? I dared not!
We put a living in the tomb.
Come,
me. Listen. Now listen and know.
We've heard the rending of coffin, the grating and iron hinges of a prison, our struggles within the covered archway of the vault.
And now, she comes for me.
The moment she'll be here, I hear her footsteps on the stair. I hear the horrible beating of her heart. She comes for me, she comes. I tell you, she stands outside the door.
As if in the superhuman energy of his utterance there had been found the potency of a spell, the huge antique panels to which he pointed drew slowly back. Then outside those doors did stand the towering and enshrouded figure of Madeline. There was blood on her white robe, evidence of some bitter struggle on every portion of her putrefied frame. For an instant she remained trembling and reeling to and fro upon the threshold. And then with a moaning cry, fell heavily in on her brother, and in her violent, now final death agony, bore him to the floor. A corpse. A victim to the terrors of all he had anticipated. This is E.G. Marshall. I shall return shortly. Of the fall of the House of Usher ends thus. I fled from the house, leaving all behind me. As I ran, I heard a sound so horrendous it made me stop and turn. My brain reeled as, looking back, I saw the mighty walls of the house burst asunder, and in a few moments the moon, breaking through scudding clouds, a blood-red moon, revealed the end. The fall of House of Usher. Our cast included Kevin McCarthy, Arnold Moss, Marion Silvis, and Robert Iden.
I sincerely hope you have enjoyed our time together as I have. I wish to thank Mr. Dolan for the opportunity to join you this week. My final program for you is one that truly chilled my spine the first time I heard it. From the series Escape, I present you with Evening Primrose from 1947. I bid you all a pleasant week and a happy Halloween.
Did you lose an election bet yesterday? Feel a bad cold coming on? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you escape.
You were groping in the midnight dimness of a gigantic department store, and suddenly you realize that you're not alone. But 100 eyes are glaring at you from the shadows, 100 hands reaching for your throat, and your most urgent desire is to escape.
Escape, produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and carefully plotted to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight we escape to the dark labyrinth of a giant department store in the dead of night, and to a fantastic world of night dwellers, as John Collier imagines it in his eerie story, Evening Primrose.
Sadie?
Sadie, hey, what's the matter? It's me.
Oh, Sam, you nearly scared me to death. What do you mean, coming in so quiet?
Hey, I didn't mean to scare you. I thought you'd be asleep. I didn't want to wake you.
Oh, Sam, I'm glad you're home.
Hey, what's the matter?
Oh, it's terrible. You got to do something, Sam.
Well, what's terrible?
It's this. Just look at this.
What's terrible about that? Looks like an ordinary pad of paper to me.
Yeah, that's just it. That's just what I thought. But it's got writing in it. It's awful.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe you better tell me what this is all about.
Well, today I went shopping down at Bracey's department store. Yeah. I needed some writing paper, so I picked this up. It was on top of the pile, and bought it and brought it home. But tonight when I opened it, I found it's got writing in it.
Well, that's nothing so terrible. Just take it back tomorrow and make him give you a new one.
Oh, no, you don't understand. It's what's written in it that's so terrible.
What do you mean, what's written in it?
Here, you gotta read it.
Oh, Sadie.
No, right now. Read it.
Look, Sadie, I'm tired. I've been
please,
bowling all
the... Please, Sam, please. Just read it.
All right, for Pete's sake. October 13th. Today I made my decision. I decided to say goodbye to the world, to get out, leave, break away. And I have done it. Ah, Sadie, there's a lot of...
Go on, read.
And now I am free. Really,
really free.
Yes,
I am free at last. The world is an intolerable place for a poet. I was broke, starving, at my wit's end. And then I had a brilliant idea. I would escape to a place where I had no need to earn a living, where I could write to my heart's content in peace and security. Where is this place? Right under your nose. So close you'd never think of it. I am now living in Bracey's department store. I have everything within arm's reach that anyone would need or desire. And it's all free. Absolutely free. I arrived this afternoon. I'd spent 3 days looking over all of the department stores in town. I decided on Bracey's because of the completeness of their food department. Therefore, this afternoon, I entered the store and went immediately to the fourth floor, to the rug department, and hid myself in this dusty, out-of-the-way corner behind a pile of carpets. Once I'm settled, I'll furnish it with the best of modern pieces from the furniture department. It's small, but I'll be cozy enough. And safe. After the store closed, I made my first venture out. I tiptoed as far as the stationery counter and got this paper, the writer's primary need. Now, after making my initial entry, I'll go out and get food, wine, the pillows for my bed, perhaps a fancy dressing gown. This is perfect. I'll be able to write here. Dawn, October 14th. I'm almost too unnerved to write this. The whole thing is unbelievable. After the store was dark and completely quiet, I crept out and started for the food department. One's footsteps echo hollowly in an empty department store at night, and I found myself gliding along the floor on tiptoe, moving as silently as possible. But the sound of footsteps persisted. Suddenly I realized they were not my own. The night watchman. I was in the Salon Moderne. Quickly I seized a mink coat from a hanger, draped it about my shoulders, and stood stock still. I could have reached out and touched him, but he passed by without so much as a glance. He started to smile, but the smile froze on my lips. There was someone else here. I was looking straight into a pair of eyes. Large, flat, luminous, inhuman eyes peering at me from among the Mrs. Tailored suits a dozen feet away. They belonged to a creature dressed as a man, but he was as pale as a creature found under a stone. His hands hanging motionless at his sides looked more like the fins on a fish than human hands. And then he spoke.
Not bad. For a beginner.
I'm sorry. I didn't know anybody else...
lived here?
Oh, yes. We live here. It's delightful.
We?
Yes, all of us. Don't you see? Look around you.
I looked around. I saw nothing. I looked again. I saw an old man come clambering out from behind a clock. There were three elderly ingenues, incredibly emaciated, pale as lace, almost transparent, simpering before the perfume counter. A chintzy lady swam out from the curtains and drapes. They came swarming thick around me, pale, thin, wispy, moving silently, fluttering like gauze in the wind, whispering.
How raw he looks.
Who is he?
As coarse as the sun.
What is he doing here?
A detective. Send for the dark men.
Yes, send for the dark men.
The dark men.
They were pressing around me, clawing, holding me, their pale faces contorted with venomous, inhuman hatred. I was paralyzed. All I could do was repeat over and over again, I'm not a detective. I'm not a detective. I'm not.
A burglar, then.
A burglar? Tie him up.
Hold him. Carry him to the police.
Send for the dark men.
Stop. Stop. Let him speak.
I'm not a detective. Or a burglar. I'm a poet.
Then what are you doing here?
I've renounced the world. I came here to live where I could be alone. Away from the world.
Why then, he's come over to us. He's just like us.
He's come over to us. A poet.
He must meet Mrs. Vanderpant.
Yes, Mrs. Vanderpant. She's coming now.
I followed their eyes toward the balcony. There, coming down the wall like an ancient spider, clambered an old lady. Wrinkled and cracked and emaciated, she must have been at least 80. A shadowy matriarch. And the things around me bowed and scraped as she reached the floor and floated toward us.
What's going on here? Where is that stupid girl? What's keeping her?
Oh, Mrs. Vanderpant.
Well, what is it? Who's this, Mr. Roscoe?
Mrs. Vanderpant, may I present Mr.
Snell, Mr. Snell, Mr. Charles Snell.
Yes, yes, of course. Mr. Snell, he is a poet, and he's come here to live.
Oh, he has he?
That's what he says, and I believe him.
Well?
He avoided the night watchman quite neatly, for a beginner.
Well, thank you.
Very well, we shall see. A poet should find inspiration here.
Mr. Snell, Mrs. Vanderpant is our grand old lady.
Oh?
I am quite the oldest inhabitant here, Mr. Snell. 3 mergers and a complete rebuilding. But they didn't get rid of me.
Oh, really?
Oh,
how nice.
Where is Ella? Where is my broth?
She's bringing it, Mrs. Vanderpant.
Oh, terrible little creature. She is our foundling, Mr. Snell. She's not quite our sort.
Is that so?
I have been here, Mr. Snell, ever since the terrible times of the 80s. I was a young girl then. A beauty, they say. And poor Papa lost his money. Braces meant a lot to a young girl in those days. So when I wasn't able to have a charge account, I came here for good. That's better than a charge account. I was quite alarmed when others began to come after the crash of 1907. But it was the dear judge.
How do you do?
Yes.
The colonel.
How do you do?
Yes.
Mrs. Bilby.
How do you do?
Mrs. Bilby writes plays.
Oh.
Anne comes of an old Philadelphia family. Oh, you will find us quite nice here, Mr. Snell.
I'm sure I will.
And, of course, all our dear young people came in 1929. Their poor papas jumped from skyscrapers. They couldn't bear to be without charge accounts either.
Do you mean all these people live here?
Oh, and many more. You shall meet them all later.
Oh, here comes Ella with my block.
Come, come, you stupid thing.
Mrs. Vanderpant is waiting.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. I'm coming as fast as I can.
Now, here. Be careful. Don't spill it.
Oh, but she's young.
Well, of course, she is a little younger than most of
them. And she's different. She's beautiful.
Mr. Snell, Ella is Mrs. Vanderpant's maid.
That's right, old man. She's really not our sort at all.
You shouldn't say such things. She can hear you.
Oh, that doesn't matter.
You'll understand these things better after you've been here a while.
But it seems to me that you would...
Mr. Snell, we have certain rules here. They are necessary for our survival. I'm sure you won't find it hard to observe them.
Well, yes, I appreciate...
I should advise that you try. If you do not, that would be most unfortunate, Mr. Snell. Most unfortunate for you.
October 15th. You can imagine my feelings last night. My first thought was to escape as quickly as possible. In fact, I planned to wait till morning when the store opened, then quit my hiding place, mingle with the crowds, and leave Bracey's forever. But just at dawn, Mr. Roscoe brought me a cup of coffee, which must have been drugged, for I fell asleep. And when I awoke, I found I had slept all day, and night was closing over the store once more. Later, I've spent my second night here. I saw Ella again. Ella, the pearl of this remote, fantastic cave. She's not like the others. A trifle pale, but otherwise normal and human and beautiful. A child of perhaps 18. She's the only thing that makes this nightmare bearable. October 20th. Escape seems almost impossible. There's a very effective burglar alarm system and the doors are all carefully guarded. But that's nothing compared to the dark men. Who are the dark men? I don't know. But they threaten any transgressor with these dark men. I shall try to discover who they are. At least I am sure I'm watched, though they've begun to trust me now. Speaking to the night watchman would be suicide. Even if he believed my fantastic story or didn't shoot me as a burglar, I'm convinced that neither Ella nor I could get out of here alive. She and the night watchman are the only real people here. And how the others hate the night watchman.
Odious, vulgar creature. He reeks of the coarse sun.
Oh, come now, Mrs. Bilby. He's really a personable young man. Very young for a night watchman.
Mr. Snell, sometimes I wonder about your taste.
You mustn't stay so much to yourself, Mr. Snell. You must become better acquainted with our ways.
Yes, old man. You must come to the play tonight. We're going to be entertained with one of Mrs. Bilby's tragic comedies. Love in Shadowland. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
I'm sure I will.
It's really a festive occasion, you know. Wanamaker's is coming over.
Wanamaker's?
Yes. The entire colony over at Wanamaker's is coming here en masse to attend the play.
You mean there are people living in other stores?
Oh, dear, yes. Didn't you know? Of course, the best people live in Brace's and Wanamaker's.
Oh, come now, Mrs. Bilby. There's some very nice people at Alton's.
I beg your pardon, Mrs. Bilby.
Oh, hello, Ella.
Good evening, Mr. Snell. Mrs. Bilby...
Well, what is it?
Please, ma'am, I'd so love to see your play tonight. May I have your permission?
Certainly not. You know better than that, you stupid creature. You know where you belong. In the basement, by the garbage cans.
But Mrs. Bilby couldn't...
Mr. Snell.
Ella, you're becoming entirely too forward of late. I'd advise you to watch your step. Remember the dark men.
Oh, no, please, Mr. Roscoe. I'll be good, I promise I will. No, please don't send for the dark men. I'm sorry, Mrs. Bilby, excuse me.
Ella, come back.
Mr. Snell, you forget yourself. Let her go.
But how can you treat her like that? Why do you always frighten her? And what is all this about the dark men?
Well, the dark men...
Oh, please, Mr. Roscoe, not now. You'll spoil our whole evening. And I do so want Mr. Snell to enjoy my play.
Very well. Later, Mr. Snell.
But I want to know about the dark men.
Later, later.
October 21st. At last, I found an opportunity to speak to Ella alone. I hadn't dared to speak to her before. Here one has a sense always of pale eyes secretly watching. But last night at the play, I induced a fit of hiccups. As I anticipated, I was sternly reprimanded and told to go and secrete myself in the basement where the night watchman wouldn't hear me. This was exactly what I had planned. I went to the basement. There in the darkness, among the garbage cans and the rats, I heard sobbing. Ella! Ella!
Oh!
Ella, is that you?
Yes.
Why are you crying? What is it, Ella?
They wouldn't even let me see the play.
Is that all?
Oh, Mr. Snell, I'm so unhappy.
There, there. You mustn't cry.
You're the only one. The only one who's kind.
Ella, why are you here? Why do they treat you so differently?
Because I'm not like them. I didn't choose to come here.
You mean you're held prisoner?
Yes. You see, I was only 6. I came here on a shopping tour with my mother. I got lost and fell asleep behind a counter. It was dark when I awoke and they found me. Some of them wanted to send for the dark men because they were afraid I would tell on them. But Mrs. Vanderpant said no, I could stay and be her maid. I've been here ever since.
Since you were 6? Haven't you ever tried to get away?
No. I don't know anything about out there. I wouldn't know what to do. Besides, I'm afraid. If anyone tries to get out, they send for the dark men.
Ella, who are the dark men?
Don't you know? Oh, it's horrible.
Tell me.
You know how people live in all the stores, at Gimble's and Bloomingdale's.
Yes, yes, I know.
Well, the dark men live at the Undertaker's.
Good heavens.
And whenever someone dies or breaks the rules, or when a burglar gets in and sees these people and might tell, they send for the dark men.
Oh, horrible.
They put the body in the butcher shop in the food department. And then the dark men come. I saw them once. It was terrible.
What do they do?
They go in where the dead person is. They have wax with them and all sorts of things. And when they're gone, there's just a wax model left on the counter. Then people put a frock on it, or a bathing suit, and mix it up with the other wax models in the windows. And nobody ever knows.
Ella, you mean all these dummies around us?
Oh, not all of them. But if you displease these people, the same thing will happen to you.
October 30th. I haven't kept up my journal. Writing has been out of the question. Once more, I'm frozen with terror. But not for myself now. For Ella. They hate her. Any time they might turn against her and send for the dark men. My mind is filled with her. I dream of her every day. I'd live to see her at night. We've managed it several times. They trust me now and let me roam about without interference. Finally, tonight, I met her again and said it. Ella, I love you.
Oh, Charles.
I love you, Ella. Let's get married. Or whatever they do here. Then we can live together in my home in the carpet department. They wouldn't dare hurt you then.
Oh, Charles,
don't look so dismayed. If you like, we'll go away from here. Maybe we can get transferred to Bergdorf Goodman's, overlooking Central Park.
Don't, Charles, don't. You mustn't.
But I love you. Ella, you're not in love with someone else.
Yes, Charles, I am.
But who? I thought you hated them all. It must be Roscoe. He's the only one that's young enough.
Oh, no, Charles, not Roscoe. Especially not him. I do hate them all. They make me shudder.
Well, who is it then?
It's him.
Who?
The night watchman.
No, impossible.
I love him. He smells of the sun.
Ella.
Oh, it was wonderful the way it happened. Don't tell on me, Charles, or they'll punish me.
Oh, no, no.
I was careless, and there he was, coming around the corner in the ladies' lingerie department. I was caught. There were only some wax models in their underthings. There was nothing else to do. I slipped off my dress and stood still.
Oh, I see.
He stopped and looked at me. And Charles, he spoke to me. He said, "Say, honey, I wish they made him like you on 8th Avenue. Charles, wasn't that a lovely thing to say?"
Personally, I should have said Park Avenue.
It doesn't matter what street. It was a lovely thing to say.
But what can you do about him? Ella, he belongs to another world.
Yes, to 8th Avenue. I want to go there. Charles, are you really my friend?
Yes, of course I am.
Then I'll tell you. I'm going to stand there again in the lingerie department, so he'll see me.
And then?
Perhaps he'll speak to me again.
Ella, you're only torturing yourself.
No, because this time I shall answer him. He'll take me away.
Take you away? Oh, no, Ella, I couldn't bear that. You don't love him. You only think you do because you think he'll take you out of here, but you don't know that he will. And I will, Ella. I've made up my mind.
No, Charles, I couldn't let you do it. Even if I loved you, you couldn't do it, Charles.
Why not?
Because you really belong here. You've become one of them now.
Ella, you mustn't say that.
It's true. And, Charles, I've got to go. There's someone watching us. I feel it.
No, wait, Ella.
Goodbye, Charles.
No, Ella. Come back. Ella!
Please, old man. You'll arouse the night watchman.
Roscoe!
Yes. Oh, love can be very upsetting, can't it?
You heard?
Yes. Just the last moment or so. Very touching. Yet it's understandable. I've been attracted to Ella myself. So she loves another, hmm? Too bad, old boy. Who could it be? Could it be that I am the cause of your heartbreak?
You flatter yourself too much, Roscoe.
Then whom? The old judge? Oh, certainly not. The colonel? Hardly.
None of those.
Oh, not one of the customers. The staff?
She loves the night watchman. Can you imagine that? She loves the...
Oh?
Roscoe, I shouldn't have said that. It's not true. At least I don't think it's true. You wouldn't... Roscoe, you said you loved her, too. You wouldn't do anything. Tell anybody. This is a secret between us. Between friends, isn't it?
Of course, old man. As secret as the grave.
She's young. Perhaps he'll leave and she'll forget him in time. Who knows? Perhaps she'll learn to love you or me.
Of course, in time.
And we'll figure a way to keep her safe here.
Absolutely safe. Now, don't you worry about it. It's almost dawn. Time for bed. Good morning, Mr. Snell.
Early evening, November 4th. I was a fool. I should have known he couldn't be trusted. He must have gone straight to Mrs. Vanderpant because this evening the atmosphere has changed. People flicker to and fro, smiling nervously, horribly, with a sort of frightened, sadistic exaltation. An informal dance in the record department has been called off. I can't find Ella. I'm going out again now to look for her. Roscoe, what have you done with her?
Shh, quiet, old boy, the night watchman.
I don't care. What have you done?
Whatever I did was for your own good as well as for the good of us all.
Wait a minute. What is that? What are those people carrying? That's Ella. She's tied up. They're carrying... Ella! Ella!
Stop it, Charles. Stop it.
Let me go.
No, stop, Charles. Stop it. You'll arouse the night watchman.
No, they're taking her into the butcher shop. Roscoe.
Yes. Those are the dark men.
Good Lord.
Midnight. I'm scribbling this last entry hurriedly. They are in there in the butcher shop with Ella. The dark men. There's only one thing to do. I'm going to find the night watchman and tell him. He and I will save her, if we can. And if we are overpowered, well, I will leave this pad on the stationery counter. Tomorrow, if I live, I will recover it. If I do not, whoever finds this and reads it, look in the store windows. Look for three new wax dummies. Two men, one rather sensitive looking, and a girl. She has blonde hair and blue eyes, and her nose turns up a little. Look for us, and then find them. Smoke them out.
Exterminate them. Avenge us.
Oh, Sam, isn't it horrible?
Ah.
We gotta do something. Tell somebody something. Oh, Sam, what'll we do?
Do? Well, nothing. Go to bed.
But Sam...
Oh, whoever wrote this has sure got a weird sense of humor. It's probably some clerk down at Bracey's who ought to be fired.
But... You mean you think it's just a story?
Are you kidding? You don't believe this stuff, do you?
Oh,
Well, I don't know.
Forget it, baby. Come on, snap out of it. I shouldn't leave you alone. You get too many ideas when I go out bowling at night.
But don't you think maybe we ought to just take it back and show somebody?
Oh, nuts. It's not worth the bother. They'd laugh at you, baby. They'd think you were crazy or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you're right. I guess I was silly.
Forget it. Oh, come on. Let's go to bed. Huh? I'm tired.
Okay. Okay, Sam. Gee, you know, there for a while I sure was scared. Oh, I even forgot what I was going to tell you. Sam, I found the cutest dress today. Only $19.95.
Yeah, baby?
Yeah. It was in the window at Bracey's. It was on a beautiful little wax model with blonde hair, blue eyes, and a turned-up nose. And there were two men standing beside... Sam!
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and tonight brought to you Evening Primrose by John Collier, adapted for radio by John Dunkel, with Elliot Lewis as Charles Snell, Paul Fries as Roscoe, and Pat Lowry as Ella. The special musical score was conceived and conducted by Cy Feuer. Next week...
After you've had a tough day at the office or leaning over a hot stove, when your four walls seem to be closing in on you, next week at the same time when you want to get away from it all, we again offer you escape.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.